What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik. And one thing I think, John, that we bring to this podcast is a social conscience. I really think we do.
I think we do bring that. If it's one thing we bring, a social conscience.
Well, we have talked about tent cities in America. We've talked about
housing,
the way that we handle housing and fair housing. We've tried to raise and elevate people's sensibilities about some of the lingering problems that we have here in this country. And as people have been remembering RFK in the 50th year of his passing, he grew a social conscience muscle in his later years that was pretty extraordinary. When I was watching some of these reflections of Robert Kennedy, and you saw him in 1968, and he was rallying poor people, white and black, and he was giving them hope that America hadn't forgotten them. And, John, many people, I think, have abandoned those things. We've grown so weary of, the efforts that have been made on poverty and so forth, not knowing what they're yielding. And but we can't forget that there are so many people still in our society that are left behind.
Oh, we can't forget. But I think a lot of people have really let us down. You know, there's a lot of people out there that make a lot of promises and then nothing happens. It's the same old, we're stuck in that hamster wheel.
Well, you know? When you think about it, I mean, if RFK was one of the last ones who really shook us to our core in terms of who we are, and then the next one was John Edwards saying he was going to have this war on poverty, you think he's still fighting that alone in some prison cell or wherever he is?
You
really
wonder.
And now you don't even hear anyone talking about that. Well, we have a good economy, but there are so many people still, I mean, in these awful situations, both in rural areas and our urban centers.
Well, you see them lined up every Tuesday. I see them lined up at the food bank, and there's people, you wouldn't believe the people that are there. It's not, it's really shocking.
Well, for the radio station that we work at, we've heard from many people that they used to be someone who could donate to one of these food banks, and now they're a recipient. And, you're always startled by that. We did that wonderful podcast, and go back and take a look at it, Alice, about the United Way. How many people are asset limited, income constrained, and yet they're employed? And you will be shocked at the numbers, even in your own home communities.
Oh, yeah. People living on the edge. It's scary. And, somebody's got to address this problem, but I don't know. I just don't see it on the horizon.
Well, when you look at it, when I think about Robert Kennedy, what was so fascinating about him toward the end, he was told, for example, when Detroit was on fire, don't go in. It's too dangerous. And then, of course, it turned out to be a ballroom in Los Angeles where it was way too dangerous for him. And he said, no, I'm going there. That's where this message needs to be delivered. And he went into a smoldering inner city against the better advice of his advisors. I don't know if we have people like that anymore, willing to risk it all.
I don't think we do. I honestly don't. It's sad. It's really sad commentary on the people we have in office these days and running for office.
Well, there's something about a special few among us, people who really try to test us and challenge our own prejudices. And John, we, of course, have said many times that we're here in the state of Connecticut. And there was one such man hailed from our state, and his name is Ned Cole. Now, he's still alive, I understand, but he's deep into his 90s. But think about this guy. During the civil rights era and later, he kept pushing discrimination to the forefront of people's thinking. And he was fascinating. I mean, he really was. Now, we think about lunch counters and restrooms and drinking fountains and buses. But in Connecticut, Ned Cole took the fight to the beachfront.
Yeah. Well, you know what? You know what's surprising to me is I grew up in Fairfield, and I never really realized that this was a problem, you know? I mean, you went to the beach, right? I mean, I was oblivious to all this.
Really. Well, easy for you to say. But there were many people living in the hot inner cities of Hartford,
right.
Bridgeport, New Haven. And even if they had access in Bridgeport, I mean, those public beaches there were pretty horrific.
They didn't have to keep them as, you know, Seaside Park and all that were not as nice as the Fairfield beaches.
And you know, Connecticut, of course, Fairfield County is one of the richest counties in all of America. It's not 90210, but it's pretty close to that. And so you look at it and you say, what would be something that would really, really get people's attention? Let's bring busloads of kids down to the Connecticut beaches, and let's see what kind of difficulty they have using this, what should be, I believe, an available waterfront to all Americans.
Yeah. I mean, you know, whatever it would cost you to park the bus, but that should be it.
No draw. There are so many restrictions that communities or little enclaves or what are called neighborhood associations or whatever. I mean, they used all kinds of tactics and devices to keep people, restrain them from using the beaches. So you can imagine somebody who's sunning herself and lives in a very Tony neighborhood in Darien, and all of a sudden descending upon these beachfronts, young kids from the inner cities. How do you think that went down?
Yeah, I don't think it probably went down too well.
No, it really didn't. And I've got to thank Andrew Carl. This is a remarkable guy. He is a professor at the University of Virginia, and he thought this was an incredible case study in discrimination in the past and still lingering, though there are many efforts today to make certain that we integrate the beaches more than we did in the past. But I don't think it's part of the civil rights struggle that many people think about, John. I really don't.
No, you know, when you think about beaches, you don't think about that as a discriminating force in our life.
And you would think that there is a doctrine, which I believe that there is, as we talked to Andrew about, that really has been not upheld well across the country. And yet there are certain states, and it really isn't red or blue, John. It really isn't. Texas has been very open about its beaches. Oregon has a really model law, so you've got a more liberal state, a more conservative state. But up in the East Coast or on the Eastern Seaboard, you've got a lot of states that have a lot of reckoning to do. And we've learned that in many cases, that as much as we think of ourselves here in the Northeast as being rather enlightened and forward-thinking, that in many cases we have not demonstrated that in our policies.
No, you're absolutely right. We're actually pretty backwards in some aspects of especially human rights. I mean, it's not good.
No, whether it's housing discrimination, it goes on. And there are still, I'm sure, difficulties getting down to some of the beachfronts here in Connecticut. Well, we will explore all of this and where we are today in America as it relates to the water's edge and its availability to all Americans. Andrew Carl, Free the Beaches.
Well, the book is called Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. And we will introduce you to Ned Cole and his battle in the state of Connecticut with Andrew Carl, an associate professor of history and African American studies at the University of Virginia. But this access to the shoreline is a big national story. And while you tell us that access to the nation's oceanfront beaches was not a major issue until after World War II, and then the federal and state governments began to invest heavily in coastal development, why was it that the federal governments and state governments at that point would think that any restrictions on access would be a good idea?
From the federal government's perspective, in the post-war era, there was a particular desire to acquire as much beachfront property as possible so as to protect the public's right to the shoreline. Unfortunately, they sort of didn't get that far in the process. There were a few national seashores that were designated, Cape Hatteras in North Carolina, later Cape Cod National Seashore, and a few smaller ones. But The effort to really sort of protect public access at a time when there was so much coastal development taking place and so much privatization unfolding, was one that was really a missed opportunity on the part of the Department of Interior, which back in the 1930s really put this as a priority but was unable to sort of carry it out. And by the time they turned their attention back to it, much of that property was too expensive even for the government to purchase.
So a lot of these private interests, were they able then to dictate the beach access issues, or were they allowed a handmaiden in most of our local communities and state governments? What was the role that government played in all of this?
Well, it varies by state, and this gets to the issue of the public trust doctrine, which is an ancient legal doctrine which became a part of U.S. common law, that states that the shoreline, and particularly the foreshore, is public land, that it can't be held by any, that you know, private property stops often at the high, either at the sort of mean high tide line, or in some states, all the way up to the vegetation line, so meaning that the entire sort of sandy beach is considered public property. The problem has been that the public trust doctrine is interpreted differently by every state, and courts have sort of come to different conclusions as to sort of how much protection that provides for the public. And one of the sort of interests of private developers and of influential homeowners and wealthy communities that had a sort of vested interest in keeping the beach to themselves was that they could oftentimes influence state governments and the courts in ways that perhaps the public couldn't.
And what is a narrow definition of this doctrine? I mean, give us some of the ways that they have tried to keep people away.
Well, you can sort of, one way is that a narrow definition could be one where, you know, you draw the line, say, to the, you know, the mean low tide mark, or in the case of, and this is somewhat exceptional, but the case of some states that really interpret the public trust doctrine in its sort of original form, which back in the 18th century, the public trust doctrine was meant to protect the public's right to fishing and navigation, not recreation. Mm. So some states actually say that, you know, that the public trust doctrine only protects those rights that were originally intended, and that if you're seeking to use the beach for recreational purposes, then you don't have any sort of right, you're not protected under that doctrine.
Where have the courts been on all of this? I would have imagined that over time there would have been something akin to Brown versus the Board of Education when it comes to something like access to the oceans, you know, on our two coasts or in the Gulf of Mexico.
Yeah, so it has mostly remained at the state court level. There hasn't been a sort of, you know, there was an effort, and as I write about in my book, to challenge or to put in place a National Open Beaches Act that would empower the Justice Department to protect the public's right to access, to ensure that there are easements and other sort of access points that would allow the public to reach the shore, and to prevent many of the exclusionary measures, whether it be fences, groins, jetties, seawalls, or other sorts of exclusionary measures. Now, that ultimately never made it far at the congressional level, but that was really a time where the public was increasingly, were increasingly growing outraged with how much of the nation's coastlines were becoming walled off to the general public.
Absolutely. I mean, we're talking about a National Open Beaches Act that you remind us was first proposed way back in 1969, and we've had so much more coastal development since. Rich people, primarily, who want to really tend to their own area and exclude others. So it's got to, I would imagine it's gotten harder over the years to even imagine this getting through.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, just recently in Florida, the state the state legislature passed and the governor signed into a law that will make it even harder for the public to access the beaches. And this was one that really expanded the ability of local communities to place restrictions on access.
So Florida did that. We've seen where Oregon, and you point to Oregon and Texas as two of the good examples where they have opened up their waterways. And when we think of Texas, we don't think of it as being a liberal state. I mean, explain to us what the politics of all of this might be.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, Texas was a case in which in the 1950s you really had a growing public outrage over the fact that, you know, that private homeowners were blocking off access to the shoreline. In particular, there was a long tradition of people sort of using the beach for transportation purposes along the Gulf of Mexico as well, and that was being restricted. And so that sort of led then to a state congressman there who had pushed forward this legislation that established a sort of Open Beaches Act at the state level that ultimately then became a model for the legislation that same congressman proposed when he got to Washington, D.C. Later on in the 1960s. So Texas was, it was a sort of time where, and the issue of beach access can often sort of scramble some of the traditional political affiliations in that it can sometimes really appeal to the a sort of populist element of those who feel as if this is kind of an issue that the public has a basic right to enjoy these public resources.
It's interesting because I was just talking to somebody who's from Connecticut, and of course your book really focuses heavily on Connecticut. Ned Cole, an activist going back to the 70s, and he's still alive today, I understand, and was truly a hero for so many going back to the many different fights for civil rights in years past. And I was mentioning that we were going to be talking about this issue, and he was the one who brought up Oregon, because he's been out there many times and said it's amazing how open their shoreline is, and they take great pride in that.
Yeah, it is, and it is something worth celebrating. I know that that's, I think it's the 50th, it was last year was the 50th anniversary of that state's Open Beaches Act, and it was something that most residents, I'm sure, are very proud of and are very happy that a previous generation had the initiative and the foresight to protect this resource from both overdevelopment and privatization. And that's kind of one of the arguments that I make throughout the book, or at least I try to show through this history, is how oftentimes the sort of beach access restrictions fuel the very types of sort of coastal development that are bad for coastal environments. That by allowing sort of private homeowners to be able to claim the shore for themselves, or to be able to, or say, resort developments and other sort of commercial establishments to sort of block off areas and call it, part of their property, that also then sort of makes it another asset, another feature that only sort of, drives up property values, but also sort of does, leads to sort of overdevelopment.
And I do want to talk about the environmental impacts, but I'd like to go back to Ned Cole here in the state of Connecticut, from which we broadcast and podcast. And I want to talk about it because we're a supposed bastion of liberal thinking, and yet we have put up all manner of ordinance and regulation to keep people out. And we've got to ask ourselves, and Ned Cole certainly put this front and center, and I want you to talk about him and his movement here in Connecticut, but about race, that a lot of it was trying to keep black folks from the shoreline where a lot of wealthy white folks were enjoying their lives.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that I discovered in writing about and researching Connecticut was how segregation was carried out through very sort of subtle, ostensibly colorblind mechanisms, oftentimes very much through sort of land use policies and practices. In Connecticut, you have profoundly segregated, or certainly at the time in which Ned Cole was most active, profoundly segregated housing markets.
Oh, but we still do. We still do.
Yes, and oftentimes segregated both through lending practices and banks, but also through local ordinances, zoning laws, other sort of ways in which communities could kind of put up walls around themselves that proved to be sort of insurmountable for many people of color as well as poorer Americans. And so that was something that I think really my book tries to call attention to, is the way in which racial segregation and sort of class segregation as well was carried out in these sort of ostensibly liberal communities.
And many of us know about a lot of the civil rights movements down south, Montgomery, Memphis, and whether it's the lunch counter or the bus. But the ocean, I don't think a lot of people really recognize how much a part of the story that is, and why Ned Cole decided to use this symbol of the sand curtain, as you call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, during the Civil Rights era, beaches were one of those flashpoints of racial conflict, as well as a place that that was targeted by civil rights activists in efforts to desegregate public space more generally. You had Biloxi, Mississippi was the site of one of the most notorious attacks on peaceful civil rights protesters in 1960 when they attempted to desegregate public beaches in that state. And the issue really sort of comes down to this, you know, both the kind of question about racial justice, but also about the public's right to public space. You know, beaches, you know, again, are, you know, at least the sort of, you know, there's no question that the wet sand portion of beaches are public property. And so, and many people sort of instinctively feel that the entire beach should be public property. And it seems as if it's sort of kind of, you know, almost as synonymous with freedom and openness and sort of, you know, bringing people together. And that always, you know, and that's an issue that Ned Cole ultimately sort of latched onto, was the fact that, you know, here's a place that should be one that brings people together, that should be open and free for all to use without restrictions, and yet it is instead one of the most restrictive places.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
we
message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
How do you get down to the wet sands when you've got parking regulations, limits, even town residents in Connecticut who felt that they were being discriminated against because they weren't members of private associations? Talk about the various devices and techniques that were used and are still being used to limit access.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue. I mean, if you can't get to the beach from the land, then that right is very hollow indeed. And so, you know, not only do you have, you know, various forms of privatization, you know, lines of, you know, private homes that are blocking access to the shore, but also even with public beaches. And this was something that was particularly pronounced in Connecticut, especially among some of the wealthier, more exclusive communities, is that their public beaches would be essentially public in name only, that they would have either restrictions on you know, the requirement that you would have to purchase beach tags, which is, you know, that there's a good case to be made for why you might charge an entrance fee, especially if it's, you know, if you have facilities that need maintained. But these beach tags and other entrance fees were often very onerous for non-residents to purchase. So you would have communities that would say, require you to go drive to the other side of town to some, you know, town office building that might not even be open on the weekends to purchase a beach tag to get access to the shore, which for most, you know, families coming in from out of town made it practically impossible to get onto the beach. You also had, as you mentioned, restrictions on parking, or just removal of parking spaces in general, so that the only people who could make it to the shore were those who lived very close to it. There was a variety of sort of mechanisms that ultimately, you know, made it very difficult. And by the, you know, by the time that Ned Cole and was making this an issue, by my calculation, there were fewer than, you know, 7 miles of the state shoreline, and this is a, you know, pretty expansive shoreline, over 253 miles, that was open to the public.
Absolutely. Now, you say it's a lot better today in Connecticut, and is that by real dint of legislation, ordinance, or is that just something slugging it out one community after another? How's it gotten better?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it has in the sense that the Connecticut Supreme Court ruled in a very important case in 2001, which I document in the book, that the most blatant forms of exclusion, such as what the town of Greenwich used, which essentially they had a law that said if you weren't a resident of the town of Greenwich, you couldn't get on the beach, period. They said that was unconstitutional, that you couldn't say, deny non-residents access to public beaches. So that brought down some of the more blatant forms of exclusion. I think that there's been a slight but noticeable change in the sort of culture of many shoreline communities, in that they have come to recognize that, or at least accept the fact that the public has a basic right to enjoy the shoreline and enjoy public beaches in particular. But you've also seen the reemergence of some of these more subtle forms of exclusion that have long been a sort of part of their sort of arsenal, if you will. So it's gotten better, but I mean, it's also, you know, it should also be mentioned that, you know, there has been no court case that has ruled on the rights of private beach associations, you know, these sort of private homeowners communities or even, you know, country clubs or other sort of, you know, members only spaces. Now, they still have enjoyed the same rights to exclude the public as ever.
I know, and I'm shocked at that. I know a friend of mine built and restored some property in Clinton, Connecticut, right on the shoreline. And I've got to say that it seems so limited, because he was telling me about the association that they have there. So I'm really wondering why there has not been a court case that definitively declared that unconstitutional.
Well, I mean, there was definitely attempts to at least build momentum toward a case in the 1970s. And the 1970s was a decade, as I write about, where you saw cases all around the country challenging beach access restrictions, challenging the right of you know, wealthy communities to exclude the general public. But in Connecticut, there were the attempts to, at least at that during that decade, to challenge access restrictions were focused primarily on municipalities. And not to my mind was there any case that actually sort of challenged the rights of private beach associations to exclude.
And yet they would seem to be the most exclusive of all, though, of course, public accommodations versus private. But how we ever let some of these things become privatized is what amazes me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, it happened in such a rapid fashion in Connecticut in particular. I mean, the rise of these private beach associations were proliferating before the World War II, and by the time, and they were very much a kind of a reflection of the how exclusive the shoreline was becoming during those decades, and how it was a place where upper middle class families, those who were fortunate enough to be able to own a summer home, could purchase a home on in one of these exclusive communities. Many of them, and to also, I should also point out, you know, not all of them were populated by rich people. In fact, some of them were kind of more middle class. They were some, especially as you got to the eastern half of the state, a lot of the beach associations were kind of more identified with particular ethnic groups or religiously affiliated. So you had the sort of, you know, the Irish Catholic beach, you had the Italian beach, but they were also, again, you know, once, you know, regardless of their sort of economic background or their sort of social standing in society at large, once they were down there on the shore, they could be just as exclusive and exclusionary as the wealthiest community. So one of the things that my book is also talking about is, you know, a sort of culture of exclusivity, one that you didn't have to sort, you know, if you, that, you know, you, regardless of where you stood vis-a-vis others, you could still sort of embrace it.
And you also talk about the fact that many of the public beaches available to people in urban areas like Bridgeport, overcrowded, poorly maintained, even the New Haven shore, and a lot of that persists today.
Yes, I mean, that's the tragic sort of other side of this story is how in some of the older industrialized cities in Connecticut, and also you know, throughout the state in poorer neighborhoods, you would have often dilapidated, polluted, and dangerous places of play that sometimes would you know, endanger children, and very much reflected the kind of uneven provision of recreational resources, oftentimes along racial lines.
Has the Eastern Seaboard been one of the more intense arenas for the imposition of these physical and legal barriers designed to assure exclusivity? I think you do point that out. And why is that? The Eastern Seaboard thought to be rather allowing, and maybe it's only situationally liberal, but explain what's been going on the Eastern Seaboard.
Yeah, I mean, it's the beach access exclusion is particularly pronounced in the Northeast, and I don't think that's any coincidence, given both the sort of density of the population along the sort of northeastern corridor, as well as the sort of stark divisions between wealth and poverty, and how oftentimes pockets of wealth and also areas of deep poverty reside very close to each other. So, you know, for instance, the town of Greenwich, Connecticut, you know, one of the wealthiest towns in America, you know, on both sides of it are poorer and very heavily minority communities. And I kind of trace out in my book this relationship between, you know, the closer a well-to-do, predominantly white municipality was to predominantly black or minority communities, the more likely it was that they would have very restrictive beach access policies. Conversely, you know, if you go all the way out to the eastern end of Long Island to East and Southampton, you know, also very wealthy communities, but also
sure,
ones that are very inaccessible to the general public, their beaches are free and wide open to anyone.
Yeah, but the opportunity to get out there is limited. What about,
exactly,
you know,
yeah.
Richard Rothstein, we interviewed him about his book, The Color of Law, and I think John and I were both very surprised at how much the federal government really led to segregation by virtue of that which they would underwrite in terms of mortgages, making developments like Levittown totally free of any minorities. So the government has been complicit in a lot of this. We think the federal government has been one of those equalizers trying to help people gain access. To what extent has the federal government encouraged the kind of coastal development that has led people to want to protect very aggressively their private property on the shoreline?
Oh, well, that's a great question, because they've been instrumental, and certainly since the 1960s, following the creation of the National Flood Insurance Program, which provides federally subsidized and, you know, artificially cheap flood insurance, which many critics have said has only encouraged building and then rebuilding in areas that are manifestly unsuited for development, in particular coastal areas. You also see really, you know, early on, you know, in my story when I'm talking about the, you know, the sort of post-war era, just massive amounts of federal dollars being spent on infrastructure, being spent on shoreline stabilization. So, you know, dumping millions of dollars through the, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers on projects aimed at sort of helping to stabilize shorelines and make them sort of attractive to commerce, development, and sort of growing these coastal economies. And then also as well, as you sort of, you know, mentioned, connecting this to Richard Rothstein's book, the role that the federal government played in segregating communities, funneling, you know, mortgages and other sort of assets toward suburban all-white communities. That was the same in along coastal Connecticut as well, in the sense that you had a real sort of prioritization of these communities and their needs that was both reflected in federal policies and then also at the state level as well.
Well, Connecticut bought into the suburban solution hard and fast, and we can see some remnants of that in all policies in the state. Now, I want to get back to that issue of the environment, because you say in your book, Free the Beaches, that America's beaches both reflect and magnify the stark racial and class inequalities that plague our nation and present a greater threat to affect climate change. Now, the first may be obvious to us, and you've described it in detail. The second, not so much.
I mentioned a moment ago the continued development, reinvestment in coastal property, in coastal communities, and particularly not just in of helping to sort of fuel private property development has made it harder for us to respond to and adapt to the threat of sea level rise. I mean, the clearest example of that was following Hurricane Sandy and the damage that it did to the Northeast in 2012, a moment where we should have begun having a real, you know, honest discussion about the future of coastal America and the future of communities that are located dangerously close to the sea, and the future of the sort of, you know, the types of development that we see there. But because these communities have often really sort of, you know, not only become established there, not only have sort of people sort of invested heavily both in their homes and understandably so want to sort of, you know, protect their investments and protect their property, but we have sort of been reluctant to kind of address the real long-term, very existential threats that sea level rise poses. And I argue that one of the things that's keeping us from that is because of how much we've invested already, and also because of the way that we treat the shoreline as, you know, or at least, you know, communities often treat it as their own private property, as opposed to treating it as a common resource that everyone, the entire public, has a stake in. And because we've sort of narrowed the number of stakeholders and sort of narrowed it down just simply to those who live and who own property along the shoreline, we ensure that they're the only ones who will really have a seat at the table when it comes time to decide on what to do next.
I think some of us who live inland wondered, after some of these calamitous events, I know that we did respond with policies that required people to rebuild but put things on stilts and so forth. I mean, how much is that just a prophylactic as opposed to saying, hey, look, we've got to move you back here and we've got to take away some of your property and maybe it's eminent domain, whatever it may be, because we have to protect this shoreline, which, by the way, as you point out in the book, is ever changing. I mean, people think it's a constant, but it's not.
That's one of the more remarkable things about this whole story, is that even as, you know, different groups of people are fighting over the beach has its own plans, and the beach doesn't live by our rules. Beaches are in constant motion. They do not stay in one place. And so one of the real follies here is this idea that we, as either, you know, as homeowners, as local communities, as a nation, can actually sort of hold beaches in place and turn them into sort of, you know, just like any other piece of property. And when they're not like any other type of property, they're very fragile, highly mobile, you know, very dynamic ecosystems that are manifestly unsuited for the types of development that we often see taking place. And so I think, you know, this is, again, one of those issues, you know, requiring homeowners to put their house up, you know, a couple more feet is really, as you said, sort of just putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound that is not going to heal.
Now, you're really sanguine in the book, suggesting that we can't reverse engineer decades of reckless, profit-driven beach development, but that we can take steps to prevent private interests from erecting various of the barriers that we've been talking about and influencing lawmakers in the future. What can we do?
Well, we can look to what California did for in particular. I mean, they in the 1970s, and that's, you know, one of the real sort of one of the achievements of the open beaches movement was born out in California when in 1972 they enacted they passed a ballot initiative that created the California Coastal Commission in response to the very types of sort of forms of privatization, overdevelopment, as well as some environmental disasters that had been a byproduct of that overdevelopment and sort of, you know, allowing private interests to sort of dictate and manage the shoreline. And citizens of the state of California rose up and voted to enact this commission that has had great powers to both limit development and ensure that the public has access rights. And I should also mention that the California Coastal Commission is also being threatened right now in a case that is challenging its the very powers that voters gave it back in the 1970s.
If I go back, I read this quote to you. I want you to respond in a couple of ways. In recent years, fences and barricades have blocked the public right to access to our seas. We are becoming a landlocked people, fenced away from our own beautiful shores, unable to exercise the ancient right to enjoy our precious beaches. Now, when I read that quote, that's from a Texas senator, not Ted Cruz or John Cornyn. That goes back to 1969, Ralph Yarborough. And if he came back today, he was a liberal Republican, I think.
He was a liberal Democrat.
Oh, he was a Democrat. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But explain to me, I mean, what would he say today? I mean, here we are many, many years later.
Yeah, Ralph Yarborough would be horrified as to what, you know, and really dismayed over how little progress and how has been made on this issue. I mean, he along with Bob Eckhart, a Texas congressman, as well as some other notable names like Scoop Jackson, the senator from Washington State. There was a fair number of people in Congress at the time who were really thought this was a serious issue and that action needed to be taken before it was too late. And unfortunately, now in some respects, I mean, it's not too late for all of coastal America, but many of the places that those advocates at the time were looking to protect and also really areas that they wanted to restore to the public have only become more blocked off and become more developed. Now, I'll also say that, you know, there has been progress made and a lot more awareness about sort of the fragility of coastal ecosystems, about the need to protect dunes, about the need for conservation of resources. But the issue of the public's rights to enjoy this and the notion that that's not incompatible with the interests of conservation. In fact, actually, as I sort of suggest in the book, is actually an essential ingredient toward a more sustainable, manageable relationship with these very, you know, dynamic and fragile environmental spaces.
Just a few more questions for Andrew Carl. The book is called Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline, that being in Connecticut. Are there any champions today? Anyone like Ralph Yarborough? I mean, has anyone really taken this up as their cause?
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, the Surf Rider Foundation has been instrumental, at least in the courts, in fighting against access restrictions. They have been very constantly vigilant in fighting to protect the public's right to access shorelines. They've been a very important player, in at least especially when it comes to the courts, and ensuring that these rights are the rights that we already enjoy are protected. On the issue of coastal environments and the sort of the challenges they face with regards to development, I'll like to mention Orrin Pilkey, who's a sort of has been writing on this issue for decades now, a prolific scholar of and a sort of coastal scientist who has written for public audiences, is the founder and I think emeritus director of the Center for the Study of Developed Shorelines. He's been someone who has written and has been a sort of very vocal proponent of what he calls retreat, you know, the need for us to begin a process of retreating from these, you know, very overdeveloped and often environmentally reckless areas.
But, Professor, I'm talking about anyone in the Senate, any of our presidents since. I mean, has anyone really taken this up? Some say we've got to get to space, we've got to get to Mars, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, we've got to end cancer. What about making certain that the shoreline is protected? Any true champion in the public sector?
Not that I'm aware of, and if I've overlooked anyone, I'm looking. I love to hear from them, but I do. I wish that there were more vocal champions of beach access and people. And again, regardless of where you stand on the issue, just drawing attention to the real threats that coastal environments face and the real challenges we as a nation face when it comes to developing an equitable and sustainable land use policy for beaches in America, which is only going to become a more pressing matter as we face the reality of sea level rise.
In closing, I know this is difficult to say, any chance that the National Open Beaches Act, again, first proposed in 1969, might ever come up again for a serious look and vote, or any chance of a Brown versus Board of Education federal lawsuit that might deal with this issue in a more holistic way?
Well, who knows? Maybe someone will read my book and be inspired by the story it tells. And I think, you know, certainly, you know, the sort of spirit of Ned Cole's activism in Connecticut is one that certainly could teach us a lot here in this current moment when we're being besieged by so many issues, and it seems as if wealth inequality and racial injustice has only grown worse. Well, you know, these were the issues that Ned Cole in Connecticut was fighting against in the 1960s and 70s, and that fight still remains with us today.
I want to encourage people to read the book, but just because we have the bragging rights of being from Connecticut, there's a lot of things that have been said about Connecticut that aren't terribly flattering, and I understand that, believe me. But Ned Cole, he was just an incredible, still is alive and not as active as he once was, but give people an inkling of how unique this particular activist was for his time and in his place.
Yeah, Ned Cole is a fascinating individual and really an activist like no other. He, in 1964, he was a young college graduate who was working in the insurance industry in Hartford, like most people working in Hartford were doing then, and he quit his job and started what he described as a domestic peace corps organization that he called Revitalization Corps. And the goal of it was to wage what he called a war on apathy. And he wanted to wage that war in those middle-class white suburbs where he thought, you know, Americans were becoming numb to the challenges that we as a nation faced and becoming numb to the problem of racial inequality and racial injustice. In fact, you know, issues that they were, by virtue of sort of, you know, fleeing the cities and moving into these all-white suburbs, had contributed mightily to. And so the goal of Revitalization Corps, as he initially saw it, was to sort of bring people together, to sort of bring middle-class white suburban families into sort of greater contact and communication and deeper understanding with African-American families living in inner cities such as Hartford and Harlem and elsewhere. And so he sort of began as someone who really had a kind of a liberal, sort of, you know, very kind of liberal understanding of the sort of problems that were facing the country on with regards to race. And as part of the sort of various projects he was doing at the time, one of them included sort of bringing underprivileged children from, you know, urban ghettos down to beaches in the summer to get them out of the city, expose them to new environments, and hopefully sort of expose people in those communities to people of different backgrounds.
And of course, they were so warmly received.
And that's what radicalized him on the issue, because he actually was kind of naive at the beginning. He thought that he actually kind of assumed that this wouldn't be a big deal, that, you know, the beach belongs to everyone, and why wouldn't they be welcome there? Well, once he got there and he realized that, A, there was very few beaches that they could even access legally, and B, the ones that they did go to, they were not welcomed at whatsoever, that he realized that there was a real problem here.
Absolutely. Well, you document it so well in the book, and I thank you for doing that because I think he deserves recognition. I had forgotten that he ran for president and actually got on a debate stage back in the 70s. So,
Even though he was too young to serve at the time, but he was still able to get onto the New Hampshire primary ballot and into a nationally televised debate, where he famously pulled a rubber rat out of his coat pocket and held it up as a way to draw attention to the issue of urban poverty.
Remarkable man.
He knew how to attract attention, and he knew how to sort of make people aware of the issues that he cared deeply about.
And when those yellow buses started rolling toward the shoreline in Madison and Darien, that certainly got people's attention, as your book does. Free the Beaches, the story of Ned Cole and the battle for America's most exclusive shoreline. Andrew Carl, thank you so much for being part of America Trends.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.